Welcome to all of you. So I will offer some reflections and then open for dialogue. Usually I talk the whole time, but whether that's good or bad news, that's not happening tonight. And not happening because there are, these are questions and inquiries that are active in my own mind and active within the Buddhist community and want to engage on that, these questions. So what does it mean to have a good life, to lead a good life, to be led by goodness? As a kid, I was concerned that I would never have an answer to that question, or even a partial answer. And I was just almost temperamentally suspicious of all the answers that were proffered by our culture of what a good life would be. I was an aversive type from very early, and I could just like, the sort of models, the philosophies of happiness that were on offer, I knew were somehow incomplete. And so I wasn't exactly looking for it, but found the path, and it came in the form of a couple housemates who were meditators. They were in a young adult sangha from Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, and I started practicing with them, and I got into practice really, really not knowing where it would lead. And the truth is, the Dharma is always kind of more than we bargain for. You know, you've practiced enough, you've had that insight. Like, wait a second. Sort of, you know, we get into the practice with usually a much more narrowly circumscribed vision of what the path is, and we sort of, it's almost like we're trying to just augment our neurosis with the path, you know, like an addition that's sort of like grafted into our life. But the Dharma wants more and more of us, right? And so I'm like very, just kind of wary, and I'm sort of like dipping my toe in and pulling it out and just sort of like, is this weird? You know, basically, like, am I getting into something that's not right for me? But I was, something in my heart was compelled, and I just kept going quietly. And some of the kind of evolution in my own heart, some of it was dramatic of something, a sense of like, oh yeah, there's a before and after to this moment. But the vast majority of the changes were much more kind of gradual, in the way Suzuki Roshi put it, is like getting wet walking in the mist. And a lot of the kind of ways that we shed suffering, the ways that I was shedding suffering, was like I sort of almost only recognized it in retrospect. I would sort of, it wasn't like, oh, there was some bit of clinging and it was obvious when that fell away. It was more like I would sort of look around the ecosystem of my life and realize like, oh, I'm not suffering in the same way that I remember, at some point I felt like, I just felt happy enough, you know, like kind of amazed how something in my heart felt complete, and felt like, very blessed to have found the path for it actually to have taken hold of my mind and heart. And this was a benefit for me, but also for all the people who have to deal with me, right? Like, less annoying, which is good, you know, right? And there are, practice evolves in phases. We get comfortable within a particular Dharma understanding, and then something happens. Something happens in the world, something happens in our life, we're surprised by something. We all of a sudden, life somehow spotlights some layer of delusion that we were not attuned to. And of course, delusion always feels like the truth until it doesn't, right? And it's fine. It's like important that we have times when we just get comfortable within a view of practice, a view of ourselves, a view of suffering, a view of the good life, and then the rug gets pulled out, yeah? And this is an important kind of dialectic in the path of practice, of kind of comfort, protection, refuge, and then disruption. Yeah. And we see our clinging, we see different parts of our mind in a new light. And for me, I think something that I've been kind of quietly grappling with in my own heart is it's just like, okay, I'm happy enough. And is it justifiable for me to continue fiddling with these subtle strands of clinging in my life in the face of the enormity of suffering and despair in the world? Yeah. And what felt like completely precious, sacred, like all the it started to feel at moments like just asking myself the question, is this decadent? You know? Is there something self-indulgent, right? Which is that's an unsettling question to ask as a Dharma teacher, right? Is my practice indulgent? How do I live a good life? How do I allocate my energy? What's the relative emphasis on my own practice, on supporting others' practice, or on contributing to the welfare of people in a totally different way? And the question is sort of arising, like, okay, I didn't get into practice in order to radically change the world. I wanted to transform my own heart, to weaken the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion in my own heart. That was the aspiration. And what is the relationship between that practice and collective suffering? Yeah. And this is more and more a kind of point of friction, and it's sort of scrambling the minds of meditators in a certain way. And I don't have answers, but I want to propose some questions as we have some dialogue. So there's some sense of I traced out three potential orientations to, like, how does insight meditation practice relate to collective suffering, to the How ought we think about climate change, for example? Yeah. So, the first kind of relationship is something like ignoring it, yeah, which you can make a strong textual case from the suttas for not getting involved. Yeah. Like when you actually, yeah, when you look in the suttas, you can make other cases, I'll go on to sketch that out, but you can very clearly make a case for, like, a part of the Buddha's aspiration was something like, get me out of here. Yeah? Like, samsara is hopeless. And the project that I'm undertaking is a radical, you know, unearthing of the suffering in my own heart mind. And I do this not just for my benefit, but for all those around me. But the path is a path of we make ourselves the problem. We to use a Tibetan phrase, we drive all blames into one. That's a powerful gesture, yeah. And it may be that. That to actually transform the heart in certain ways, we have to get very simple. We can't actually get involved in broader questions. We sort of have to take full responsibility for the suffering in our minds, even though we know there are causes outside of ourselves involved. Yeah? Mm-hmm. But it's like, okay, for this practice, I'm going to drive all blames into one. Sometimes mindfulness is, modern secular mindfulness is critiqued as like leaving out the sila, leaving out the ethics, and so one writer, Ron Purser, makes like a case, is the involved with that word McMindfulness, you know, the sort of like dumbing down of mindfulness practice, and his argument is like modern mindfulness stuff has left behind the ethical roots of Buddhism, and that this actually has to be reclaimed in order to enact his program of kind of like a radical political program. But it's actually easier to make secular mindfulness compatible with radical politics than it is to make the suttas compatible with yeah, that makes sense? So this is a scholar, Amod Lele, in a kind of critique. Purser laments the modern mindfulness's emphasis on results prevents it from being offered as a tool of resistance, restricting it instead to a technique for self-care. But why would we have ever thought it was a tool of resistance? It was not such a tool, after all, in the hands of the Buddha of the suttas. His monks did, in important respects, opt out of the prevailing social order and indeed occasionally criticized it. But they did not fight it, they did not try to change it. Rather, they created a separate monastic social order within the existing one, an order that one could even call privatized. Yeah. Now, I'm suggesting one way of relating to the suttas is a kind of like, we're disengaging. Yeah. And on the one hand, we see there are, when religion and politics get tangled up, there's a risk to the integrity of the religious tradition, right? It gets very complicated. But on the other hand, it really does feel like as we become more sensitive to the suffering of the world as we become more conscious of the civilizational threat of climate. Like, it just, that no longer feels really tenable. Just to say, like, all right, our project is entirely divorced from suffering at the mass level, yeah? So, okay, I'm sketching out that first option of ignore, right? And then the second kind of relationship between the Dharma and the narrow sense and collective suffering is to really source a project of engagement based on Buddhism. Yeah. And so if you follow along this stuff, like David Loy would be one of the kind of teachers, writers around this. So this is an attempt to actually look at the Buddhist tradition and to say, like, okay, what are the tools within the Buddhist tradition that can allow us to ask and answer questions about collective suffering? How can we, for example, use the teachings on greed, hatred, delusion to create a kind of program of social engagement, of transforming society? How can we use the teachings on compassion to change society, right? And so it's an attempt to really source a political philosophy from Buddhism. Yeah. This is Loy says, today, thanks to their increasing technological powers, institutionalized forms of greed, ill will, and delusion are aggravating the world's suffering. In response, we're called upon to become bodhisattvas, to contribute what we can according to our situation. Our sick ecosystems and social systems do not afford us the luxury of devoting ourselves only to our own enlightenment. Yet we will not be successful as bodhisattvas unless we pursue our own awakening. Ultimately, those liberations can't be distinguished. To wake up is to realize that I am not in the world. I am what the world is doing right here and now. When the Buddha became enlightened, the whole world awakened in him and as him. The world begins to heal when we realize that its sufferings are our own. So, this is another possibility, that we're actually drawing from the teachings in order to catalyze social movement. And because at some level, like, engaging with the suffering of the world depends on the collective motivation, and religion is very good at pulling the levers of motivation, right? Like, this is, it can rally us to do things, right? If we believe in heaven and hell, we're going to act in certain ways. If we believe in Buddhist theology, we're going to act in certain ways, right? And so this is one way of, like, trying to meet collective suffering. And there's more and more of these kind of projects, I would say. And the risk in this that I see is that the Buddhist practice, the technology of it, really, it really is focused around individual liberation. This, by the way, all of this is totally controversial and worthy of fighting about. That's why I want to open it up. So, but, like, when I actually think about, like, what is Buddhism best at doing, there really are other wisdom traditions that I would look to in terms of societal transformation. But, like, what is it great at doing? It's great at unburdening our hearts, yeah, of suffering, and creating people who engage with the world in ways that are non-harming. Yeah, but that's different than a kind of political project. So what can happen is it's almost like we start multitasking in our practice, and we're trying to kind of like save ourselves and save the world at the same time. And that there's a certain kind of singularity that's needed for practice to have its most liberating effects. We really have to get simple. Yeah. So the third possibility is something that acknowledges that the Dharma is a medicine, maybe the only medicine for certain forms of dis-ease. Yeah. Like for certain subtle forms of suffering, I can't imagine. It's like you could do as much, and I have a lot of reverence for psychotherapy, but you could do a million years of psychotherapy and you would not uproot some of the forces of suffering in the mind. There's like a different medicine for certain forms of suffering. And the Dharma is just so exquisite in meeting the subtleties of clinging and catalyzing these changes in our own hearts. But just because it's the only medicine for some forms of suffering does not mean it's the medicine for all forms of suffering, right? And in universities, like, there's usually different disciplines, right? There's like the biology and the math and chemistry and sociology and all these different disciplines. They're separate. But another way of thinking about human knowledge is that sometimes there's a problem, and then you bring to bear all these different disciplines. It's an interdisciplinary approach, right? And suffering is an interdisciplinary problem. Yeah? Suffering, like dukkha, is an interdisciplinary problem. And in a certain way, we need to source wisdom from all corners of our civilization for this. And so this kind of this third possibility, this sort of integrative possibility, is one where Dharma practice it remains in a certain way oriented around individual freedom, and that somehow but there's an acknowledgement that to live a full ethical life entails engaging in a lot of different ways, yeah, and how that looks for us, how we do that, how we actually engage, it's a question. But it's like in a way the Dharma catalyzes an ethical evolution for us, where we're more willing to renounce or to be courageous or to engage, but we're not necessarily, we're like using other traditions, science and other wisdom traditions, to engage with the suffering of the world. These are the questions that I'm like, feel more urgent, because I do have the sense in practitioners that on the one hand, when people come to a group like this or a retreat, it's just like, oh my God, just give me some, don't talk about this stuff, what I'm doing. Like, give me some shelter from the storm, you know? Like, just give me some shelter. And I have a deep kind of respect for that. And in some ways, want to meet that need, right? Because it's like, you know, I'm tapped out. I cannot give more. I'm so flooded and inundated by my own suffering, the suffering of the world, that I need refuge. Yeah. And so on the one hand, I really do feel that in people. And on the other hand, people are starting to have some of what I was describing in my own practice, a sense of just like, is this okay to do? Like, is this actually, how does individual suffering and collective suffering relate to each other? Where's Buddhism in the mix of this? And if Buddhism doesn't give me tools, then I'm going to leave that, you know, or something like this. And so the Dharma is being formulated and reformulated in interesting ways. And it's great that we have a range of articulations, David Loy, or lots of different ways of approaching the practice. But like in my own heart, in being with practitioners, like, okay, what? How do we start kind of talking about this, and what are we doing? And you know, it, like, because it's for me. On the one hand, there are, and we lose sight of this. There are like, along many metrics of suffering, collective suffering, we're doing dramatically better. Yeah, like this gets lost, like in terms of the global burden of disease and extreme poverty and violence, and like there are a lot of really important metrics that are where the public perception is things are the same or getting worse, but they're actually like dramatically better than they were just decades ago. We lose sight of that, right? That's a real thing. And in a sense, as the suffering goes down, there's a phenomenon where the suffering that remains becomes more prominent. Yeah. And so we keep moving the goalposts and things look more and more bad, but it's actually better and we're more sensitive to harm and injustice. Yeah? That's all real, and all of that is, you know, there are countervailing forces that are scary, you know, of anti-democratic forces and climate, for example, climate change, which puts everything at jeopardy. And as a kind of member, you know, as a teacher and as somebody involved in governance within organizations, like it's a little bit of a question, like, okay, is climate change going to make every occupation but climate activism look crazy? Right? Could that be? Right? How do we relate to that? It's like, wait a second, I thought I was doing this, you know? And none of this has eroded my faith in the practice or what it can do. It's just, I find myself becoming more pluralistic in terms of like bringing to bear all different kinds of wisdom to suffering. And it feels important to talk about this. You know, it's like we talk about like grief at the individual level, but there's like, you know, like people grieving collectively. Like that's a real, real phenomenon. Yeah. And so, maybe I'll pause here and see. Yeah, I wanted to just open that for conversation and difference, debate, whatever. I know this is, I have very, you know, idiosyncratic views about this, but just wanted to present some options, yeah? So what's up? How is all of this sitting in your own heart? And I think we'll run a mic so everyone can hear. Yeah, I see Art. Yeah.
So this is very much alive for me. Just really questioning what what is enough and what is not. And if you read the discourses, or even you know, a lot of Venerable Anallio's stuff on early Buddhism, which I feel very drawn to. I really feel like he's drawn to what was the Buddha actually teaching? How were they actually living back then? What were they actually doing? And I'm very drawn to that on one level. And then there is stuff around, for example, climate change, diversity, the rise of nationalism, or it seems like there's a surge of nationalism around the globe. And I don't know how much that's just our view right now, our really self-centered view right now. It's like, oh, well, we're facing this, so therefore, oh, look, that's it there, and that's it there. So I don't know. And I don't know the answer. I think both are important. I think taking steps on both are important. And I do think that there's something really precious about Dharma practice itself. It really, as you were alluding to this, you just can't get to looking at some of the finer points of greed, hatred, delusion, and how this psychosomatic process creates, can further its own greed, hatred, and delusion, and how it can end it, how it can move towards that. And it's like, I know one meditation group that was like in one of their emails, they're talking about how you know, the how the Buddha was so clearly drawn towards social justice. And I was like, huh? I don't see that in what I was reading.
Yeah.
So I don't know where everything fits together.
Right. Right.
But yeah, we could just rearrange our zafus on the Titanic, on the deck of the Titanic. Or something else.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you for bringing this up. I think it's really important. I feel that the message that I get from my practice and from the Dharma in these times is to look toward, not away, and to be able to bear witness to what's actually happening with kindness. Because if I don't have that kindness enveloping me as I look toward, the dukkha is just unbearable. It's heartbreaking times we're living in, and yet I've never had a more visceral experience of impermanence than I do when I read the news. What's happening in Australia is impermanence in my face, with graphics, with human life and animal, non-human animal life, with trees, with the earth. The truth of impermanence is so undeniable in the face of what we're witnessing around the world. But I feel like it's a Dharma lesson in itself, but the teachings encourage me to look toward it, not away from it, to look toward it with kindness, with compassion.
Yeah.
And along with the Buddha now, I pay homage to Greta Thunberg.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people I can admire and emulate beyond the Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the practice is helping me not turn away and deny. Your first option didn't appeal to me at all.
Yeah. It was a straw man. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Dharma's call to move to what's happening, with what's happening, accept it as the truth of the moment. I think that's fabulous, as long as we're cloaked in or wrapped in or bathed in kindness for ourselves, as well as for the world, because it's almost unbearable without that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the practice is in our face in a way it never has been before. Impermanence is so in my face that it's hard to deny it the way I used to be able to put it on page 2.
I there are moments when, you know, the whatever the the scope of suffering is so great that you can almost get like an intuitive hit of what the collapse of kindness and love would look like, and it's like totally terrifying. Like just in one's own mind or in the social field, like oh my, you know, that is like actually fills me with terror. You know, like what it looks like without love, what community looks like without love is just absolutely terrifying. And so I think the kind of like rallying this like very courageous, loving heart in the midst of all of the anicca, the suffering, dukkha suffering, really, really crucial. Yeah, it's said like love is sort of said to be kind of like what holds the world together. You know, like that's some phrase from somewhere in the tradition. And you do get that sense of like, oh yeah, things can disintegrate, you know? And how, just unimaginably painful that is.
Looks like in the world today, you know, what it is, capitalism, corporations, and that sort of thing. And aversion is the military industrial complex, and delusion is the media. And knowing that, having that sort of perspective, then I can focus my energies in ways that are useful. For me, I feel like 80% of my energy has to be toward personal liberation, but a good 20% has to be focused on political action, of some sort of action. Just that's how I kind of see it, it's a balance.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and insofar as we have limited kind of energy, and there's sometimes when, you know, the nature of suffering. I don't say this in a pejorative way, but the nature of suffering is it's like a self-absorption, you know? Like, it just, you can almost literally feel the attentional kind of field narrow. There's even data about, like, you actually were, you know, Corey's giving those great instructions around the peripheral vision, yeah? Like, the field of attention under duress gets narrow. Like tunnel vision is a real thing, yeah? And so there are times when it's just like we are absorbed in our own struggles of one kind, and we're working to free our own heart, and there's just not much energy. But then there are times when there is energy, and whatever we have, in a sense, I want to use efficiently, you know? Like, I want to use that efficiently. I want to, like, do the most good I can efficiently. And so for me, like, one of the something that's been catalyzed is an engagement with the effective altruism movement, which is using sort of the best available evidence and very careful reasoning to try to do the most good with one's life, money, resource. And it's a very nerdy crew that's doing this work, but they're like big-hearted, you know, like very, like they're really asking the question almost like, what is the modern bodhisattva? Yeah, like how can one, we say, in Shanti Deva says, like, you know, free, you know, to free all beings, like until the last being is free, you know. But okay, that's like gorgeous and inspirational and brings tears to my eyes, but like what does it look like? What is a modern bodhisattva look like? And in a certain way, this movement around like effective altruism, like making the most good we can, relieving the most suffering we can, it gets complicated because you're weighing, how do you weigh animal suffering and human animal, so, you know, these kind of things, right? How do you weigh future generations versus what's happening right now? It's complicated, but there are like very good-hearted people who are devoting their lives to this, and many of them are just are living simply and giving money basically to the most effective ways of rescuing people from suffering, and that's very kind of inspiring to me, and that I've been. Changed my life in important ways over the recent years, and how do we do the most good we can with whatever energy we have, resources that we have that are we don't need, and what do we need? Yeah. Please.
First of all, thank you, and I thank you and Mary. Patty just said what I thought I wanted to say. I think these years ago I was studying with Yvonne Rand, and several things she taught us stay in my head. And one of the things she said was, this isn't an exact quote, but while you're busy being kind to everybody else, make sure you include yourself. And I think 30 years ago, that was revolutionary to mm-hmm. some of us.
Yeah.
And I think how much personally I can do outside myself changes from decade to decade,
sure.
and from month to month, and from week to week. And I'm not a scholar, and I'm not as assiduous as I used to be, but in all my exposures to different Buddhist teachings, I never got that, I know it's a solitary thing, but even in the Buddhist day, people lived in community, and they had to work things out together. Mm-hmm. They had to make it kind, or equal, or fair. In the early years when I was reading Thich Nhat Hanh, and he talked about, or there was talk about how he did it in his community, bringing people together and working it out.
Yeah.
And I think what we do on the individual level is kind of a reflection of what we're doing on the outside world. And that we all bring as much as we can to both levels. And it changes, it fluctuates.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
That's how I make peace with it. Mm-hmm. When I'm mm-hmm. not doing as much as I want to be doing in
right.
the outside world.
Right. Yeah, and there's a little bit of a question, like when it can kind of, I don't know, it's fraught, because it's like on the one hand, we can get completely obsessional about trying to do more, neglecting our own heart, giving beyond, like burning ourselves out in various ways, right? That like happens, you know? And then in other times we can, the other side would be like, we're, and I feel this about myself, it's like, I can do more. There's the measure of self-indulgence and laziness in my life, even though I do live a life of service. I can do more. And so part of what I try to do is actually tolerate that sense of moral incoherence, meaning that I cannot fully defend my life, and I fucking hate that, you know? Like, it's really painful, you know? Just to feel like, okay, basically, I want to think of myself as a good person, and I don't want to change my behavior. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, please tell me that's not just me. That's the, right? He's like, so it's like, oh my, oh wow, wow. Like, okay, can I just bear with that sense of disjointedness in a way that's not some weird guilt kind of thing or whatever. It's just like, can I just actually tolerate that for a moment and see what it does to my heart, see what it catalyzes in terms of my ethical life, and can I like commit in a certain way to evolving as an ethical creature, you know, like to just, will it, like, may we all become better and better. Yeah, up front here.
Yeah, the statement, I practice for the benefit of all beings.
Yeah.
And maturing ethically, morally, and relationally is, for the, as far as I'm concerned, for the benefit of all beings. That's my journey.
Yeah.
My own maturation is for the benefit of all beings.
Yeah.
So it's not selfish to work on that maturation.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it in my dealings with others,
for sure,
it's extraordinarily important, and especially when you go into political groups and service groups.
Yeah.
If you're immature and angry and don't know how to relate to others, you're useless. So I mean, and the path is that kind of spiritual, emotional maturation for the benefit of all beings.
Yeah, I feel that, but I and more and more when I say that for the benefit of all beings, I think I can do more, basically.
Okay,
yeah.
We have long lives, hopefully.
Yeah.
And this is a lifetime journey.
Yeah. No, for and it's not to undercut that. I cannot tell you how many times tears have come to my eyes in practicing with exactly that intention. How much my practice, you know, I just sat my own retreat, and it was very much dedicated. Like I actually am happy enough. I really am. That's how I feel. Like I don't actually. I'm not trying to get any happier, actually. And so the practice is like, but I impact a lot of people, you know, just not just in my, you know, personal life, but just in teaching and all of this. So it's like actively for that. And I remember this exchange where it's like, it was Bhikkhu Bodhi and about a decade ago, Bhikkhu Bodhi and a Tibetan teacher, and the teacher was talking about sort of like the doing kind of like the metta compassion kind of practice, and it was an awkward, very pointed kind of exchange. It was at a teacher's meeting, and Bhikkhu Bodhi turns to him and says, like, you have to do something, yeah, like you cannot just do your compassion practice, yeah, and I don't want to absolve myself of moral responsibility, even though I'm fully committed to what you're saying and cultivating my own heart and being a cause of less and less suffering. And it happens, we impact each other and it ripples out, and it really does. Like there are, as one researcher said, happiness is a property of groups, meaning like we ripple out. You can actually trace it out as a statistically, like the happiness ripples out. This is really important, and I don't want to get too by the kind of grandness of the metaphor fully. And it's like, okay, what else? For the benefit of all beings, if I were living that deeply, what would my life look like? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Please. Yeah.
a comment like 101. That my comment, but
yeah.
I think that it's working, the practice is working both ways. Sometimes I don't know, is it the practice or it would just my life development have changed me in this way?
Mm-hmm.
But I've only had my life development with practice. Anyway, that
it's a single, in research language, is a single subject design, and it's very hard to draw causal conclusions. Yeah.
And so I've become more and more sensitive, you know, or more porous, not that things just flow through, but that they hurt, you know?
Yeah.
When, and particularly as I go through different stages of life, I have more relationship with different types of situations. So I feel like I have more sensitivity. And then I think somehow that is really, though, calling me somehow to be present in some way or to continue to step up. And then the last thing is I think there's so many lines in the Metta Sutta that are dynamic to me, and one of them is by not holding to fixed views, because my response or my way of seeing things or the curiosity of continuing to learn about things I didn't know about before, I have to be, you know, by doing that, the way I look at things are different all the time.
Lovely, thank you, as you're suggesting, like as we practice, suffering becomes more poignant. Yeah, it becomes more poignant. We sort of like, the more deeply we actually can encounter and hold the suffering in our own heart, the more evident that is in the eyes of another. And and so life, it's not more melodramatic, but it is more poignant. You know, it's like the senses are not dulled by clinging as much. And so we're like, the heart is just more responsive, And who knows how responsive it can actually become, right?